Hello, everybody. I am your host, Jen De La Vega, and I'm very excited to talk to Alicia today.
I love it. I love being here. I love learning about words.
We are finally close to a name that we like for this behind this. This is episode 4 of the Behind the Scenes podcast, and we have finally landed on a name that we will now put on all the other episodes. And it's based on a word that I actually used in an essay very early on in my writing career. It's the word excellent, which is excellent, I think. And I was joking last week when we were brainstorming all this, and I said, excelente, like, you know, like a Ninja Turtle.
It was excellent. It was excelente. It was great.
I really like that name, and I think we're going to stick with it. I'll back up here. We were brainstorming on a website called Miro, which is kind of a visual brainstorming board. We used little post-its, and we had all these entries from Patreon. You know, I'll have to shout out our suggestions again. Complimentary, etymology, etymology, lagniap, those were all great words. But we really wanted something that was, I don't know, had a lot of fun depth to it. Like we had words like beyond or verbal, our food articulated, bottom of the bowl. We had a lot of Latin. We dove into a lot of Latin. Like, we were thinking along the lines of prandium, prandial, prandor. And it, you know, it sounds really clinical when we say it like that.
A couple of them were a little clinical too.
Some of them,
postprandial, got a little clinical.
Excellent, is fit to be eaten, or it's edible. That's what the word means. It's an adjective, or it can be a noun. So like a thing, especially a vegetable, which is fit to be eaten. When you look up excelente or excelenta or excelento, it goes into Latin and Spanish for the same, to be eaten, or bait, which is really fun to think about.
I was going to say something about clickbait, but that's not why we're here. That's not why we're here.
But also, I learned that excelenta is a species of vegetable. And it's kind of amazing. Colocasia excelenta, taro root.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Yeah. So that's kind of amazing that a whole species, subspecies of vegetable is excelenta.
That's so yummy.
Yeah, it's a tropical plant grown primarily for its edible corms, root vegetable most commonly known as taro. And Colocasia excelenta has other names in different languages. So the first one is Tagalog. Amazing. Gabi or ube. And it's in Swahili, it's jimbi. It's just got so many great words for it. So it's got like this very deep definition, excelenta, excelente, excellent. So welcome to the excelente podcast.
The excelente podcast.
It's so excelente.
Love it. It just covers so much ground, which is what we're trying to do too.
Yeah.
You know, and transcend
in
a lot of
very little time and very little internet gigabyte space. We are named now. We must go forth and explain to people.
Love it. I think we got there organically too, which is also great. So it took us a couple of tries, but we got there.
Yeah. Thank you everybody for your suggestions. We love them. We wish that other podcasts haven't already gotten them. All right, let's get into the meat of the conversation, which is our next three words.
Like, we're not talking about a ton of meat, I think. Oh, we're talking about some meat today.
I was just making a joke.
I just wanted to clarify. This is not a meat-based one.
You're true. You're right.
Some of them are going to be very meat-focused.
That's very true.
But, all right, let's get into it, though.
We're going to get into it. We're going to dig in. So our next three words that we're going to discuss today are glaze, deglaze, and sweating. Huh.
So it's funny. I looked at these three words and I was kind of like, they don't, to me at first glance, they didn't seem that similar together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, they're kind of, I think of different foods when I think of them. A lot of, you know, glaze, obviously, as, you know, not a chef, I'm like, ooh, donuts.
Oh,
like,
I love I'm a chef, I think of donuts.
No. And then I had a light understanding of sweating, but I knew it was generally about vegetables. Mm-hmm. And then deglaze, I actually knew what it was, but didn't necessarily know what it was called.
So, right. That's something a lot of people do in everyday cooking, and they don't know what it's called.
So I kind of, as we, like, I researched the words and found out a little bit more, I saw some similarities, though, come together with them.
Mm-hmm. And
I realized, like, two main things, or three main things, actually.
Oh, please, hit me with it.
Well, they all deal with liquids, which yes. I think is sort of interesting, which, once again, I don't think of glazed donuts and sweating vegetables as like a liquid-based cooking process.
Not initially.
Well, initially, right. And then deglaze, also once again, didn't necessarily know what it was. Then I realized, also a liquid-based cooking process.
Mm-hmm.
And then also a big part of both, like all three of them, are aromatics.
Oh!
Which I thought was very fun and very interesting. And I'm kind of ready to like dive into how like aromatics play a part in like each of these three things. If you think I'm like kind of spot on with that one.
That is something I haven't thought about, but you are right.
Oh my gosh, that's so fun. I wasn't expecting that.
You're extrapolating information. Look at you.
I'm learning as I go. I love it.
So at the beginning of this endeavor, I explained that season two is unique from season one in that it has a purposeful order of the words. It is how you encounter them in the kitchen, in the cooking process. So glaze is first because it's a more of a purposeful thing that you do to foods. Deglaze is sort of a byproduct of cooking, sautéing, anything where food is likely to get stuck to a pan. Deglazing comes into play to bring out more flavor or to remove flavor from the pan. And sweating is not necessarily directly related to these two actions, but it is something that you do in a pan. All three of these have to do with frying pans.
That's so interesting. I actually did not pick up on that one.
Not necessarily frying pans. It could be Dutch ovens, but in the course of cooking with a vessel, these three words are quite related, which is exciting.
Actually, my third thing was I thought it was like maybe I'm wrong on this, like almost a finishing part of a cooking process. Like it's not the main part of the cooking, but it's an element that adds to the cooking.
I agree with that last part, they are elements of cooking and not necessarily the end.
Okay, right. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Right, because sweating you would not do at the end.
You do it at the beginning.
Right.
And sweating is usually a precursor to a larger dish or to a next step. It's kind of like preheating the oven, but like getting your vegetables ready for a braise or for a later saute or something else. But let's start with glaze.
Let's get sweet.
Not necessarily.
Right. Not exactly. Necessarily. Well, that's coming up. It's coming up.
But the first glaze that we thought of, obviously what you thought of, was donuts. And that's kind of the first place that I have ever experienced a glaze. Like on The Simpsons. Feel like you wrote a note about this.
I did. So I grew up, I was a hardcore Simpsons fan. I'm less so a little bit now, but growing up, I was like, every night, every Sunday, but every night at 7 p.m. was on Fox. Loved it. And Homer with his pink glazed donut. Like that was like, I see a donut, if I hear the word glaze, automatic association for me directly is Homer Simpson. Like no company, no nothing. It's Homer Simpson.
Just Homer Simpson.
Just Homer Simpson.
Yeah, I was a cake donut kind of kid. I didn't watch The Simpsons until later in life. Okay. And now I'll go to the mainstream donut shop and get the pink one because I've seen it on The Simpsons. I mean, same influence, different times in our lives.
And that's the beauty of The Simpsons, to be perfectly right. Honest. Like, it can affect you at any time of life. You just have to, you know, be willing to accept it.
This may be for a later conversation, just real quick. What is your favorite donut?
Ooh, hesitation.
How? Oh, well.
Boston cream, like off the top of my head, but it's also super messy. So it depends on
Yeah.
if I'm road tripping. Oh no, I can't. It's all of them are different scenarios. Like if I'm
Oh,
in Vermont,
true, true.
I'm getting myself like a cinnamon or an original. You know what I mean? Like I'm having it with
Whoa.
cider, you know, like I eat a lot of donuts.
I love that you have specific circumstances for your donut consumption. That is admirable. I love a blueberry cake.
Oh,
I
yum.
love a honey dip, and I love a sour cream, which are very close to each other, the honey dip and the sour cream, but subtle differences. Here at Peter Pan Donuts in Greenpoint, my favorite, shout out. Local
Delicious.
mom and pop business, very good. But what else is glazed? Let me see. There in the episode for glaze, we start off with the definition of glazing vegetables, which is not what you would immediately think when you think of glaze. You think of cakes, pies, donuts, sweet things. But in a lot of French traditional cooking, glazing is a kind of starter set skill. It's chopping your vegetables into uniform shapes and then adding a broth or sugar or butter to glaze the vegetables to give them a nice sheen. Glaze comes from, it's a 14th century variant of Middle English glacen, to fit with glass or to make shine. And it's influenced or reinforced by glazier. So it's from pottery, to cover with a shiny or glossy substance around the 1400s. It's an old word.
Interesting.
Not as old as others, but
Pretty
older.
old. It's pretty up there for, and you know, different things used for different things, pottery and food. Moved
Yeah,
around a little
so
bit.
in the sauteing process, we can glaze vegetables or meats with a broth, butter, or sugar solution. And most famously, you can glaze a ham. Around Easter time, you will hear about glazed hams a lot.
I have a question.
Yes.
You were just saying how some chefs, like, it's one of the first things they do is to chop the vegetables up. Is that actually like something, like a skill that you have to work on to do? Like, is that how you learn how to dice vegetables well? It's like also to glaze them well? Like, is that part of the training?
It's kind of the next step, yeah. Like,
Okay,
what will you
intriguing.
do with all of these vegetables that you just practiced cutting?
Gotcha. I guess I never
So
really.
go ahead.
No, I haven't really thought about like the trait, like some of the training steps. Like, when you're learning how to become a chef, do you waste food at all, or does it get, you know, is there always like a next step and part, like, is there a thought out process to all of this stuff, like
Oh,
chopping the
yes.
vegetables to learn? Okay.
It's kind of like the scientific method that we have. Your hypothesis, your experiment, your results, your conclusion. Same thing with recipes, same things with cooking school. You will learn how to dice things uniformly, and then you start to introduce the heat and then finishing in some way, and then everybody gets to take home food, which is very exciting. Side note, my favorite part of culinary school, in my short time that I was there, I actually didn't complete culinary school. Is the giveaway table. At the end of the day, there is a ton of food left over from classes, people doing things over and over again, and sometimes people don't want to take their stuff home. So, you bring your to-go box and an extra baggie or so and take home a loaf of bread that a class, practiced. I was always a scavenger like that.
I mean, it's cost effective, I would
Oh,
assume,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
and probably pretty delicious. Unless, I mean, not maybe not everyone's a great cook at that time in their life, but you know, you hope they're getting there. The enthusiasm hopefully is there.
But getting back to glaze, the principle is taking some cooking item, so either it's a pastry or a vegetable or a meat, and we are adding a liquid solution to a heat source to glaze it. So heat is essential here. Because it reduces the broth to its essential elements, so like those solids, the flavors, in a sugar solution. If we're glazing a donut, we're reducing it enough so that it can stay on there. So some glazes don't need to be heated. So like the very easiest first baking glaze that you learn is powdered sugar and water. The easiest glaze. It's a higher proportion of sugar to water. You mix it and you can play with the consistency. That was the very, very first glaze that I learned when I was a kid. I think I was maybe 8 years old when I first glazed a cinnamon roll.
I think I made a cake from like box mix and no icing in the house. And my mom was like, oh, no, we can just make icing.
There you go.
And it was the powdered sugar water situation.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to make it thinner, you add more water. If you want to make it thicker, you use less water or you add more sugar. So that's a very easy thing that you can do right now if you have that at home. And secret, you can, instead of water, use other substances like lemon juice to flavor the glaze.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite type of glaze?
Oh, goodness. I've used a very sweet wine before. I've used a muscadet. Mm-hmm. It's like a dessert wine. Just a few splashes of that in a small bowl and then like half a cup of confectioner sugar. And that is a lovely like white glaze that you can use for things. You can also use smashed up strawberries or raspberries and put it in a sieve and smash the juice out of it and then use that. So you get like a little pink tinge in your glaze.
Oh, that could be so pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Like drizzle on top of things.
Super cute.
I never even thought about that, like using different, like, I thought about maybe some, like, different liquids, but not extracting liquids from other things to supplement that into a glaze. That's so fun. That's actually a very,
juice.
Like, yeah, such a creative, like, fun thing to do, like, on the weekend or something, like, just to try out new recipes, but, like, you don't have to do, like, a ton of stuff or, like, learn a whole bunch of new things.
Oh, yeah,
but...
two-ingredient recipe. Some kind of, like, tablespoon of liquid or juice. You can experiment with this, or even liquor. or beer. I don't know if beer glaze would taste that great, but maybe you have like a framboise, like a raspberry beer or something like that. Or so a stout chocolate.
Would the
beer.
Carbonation though mess that up?
It might. I don't know. I've never tried it.
That might be a fun experiment. Okay. If anybody
tries this, folks, report back.
I feel like a beer enthusiast might want to try it. I'm just saying.
I'm curious.
Yeah, or if you're making dessert for a beer enthusiast, like, you know, how to make a, like, a, even like a Guinness glaze. You know what I mean? Like,
ooh,
someone who loves Guinness.
Ooh.
Or Guinness and Bailey's. I don't know. I feel like there's something in there.
Bailey's glaze. That's interesting because you're introducing like a milky element without it being milk.
Right.
Interesting. We jinxed on interesting.
We did. We did. I like when we can amuse ourselves like this, though. It's great.
Oh, my goodness. What else about glazes?
So I thought it was very interesting though. Is it, so you said just like confectioner sugar though, can you use anything else though besides confectioner? Can it be granulated? Like, can it be anything you find in the kitchen, like sugar in the raw, or does it have to be powder?
So that for that particular glaze, yes, it has to be confectioner sugar. Okay. I use that on baked goods. I don't use that in heat applications. I don't know why you couldn't, but I generally haven't. Okay. It's very smooth, which is ready to use. But when you're getting into the granulated sugar, Demerara sugar, brown sugar territory, you want to start applying heat to these glazes so that you don't get that grainy, crunchy.
That's what I was curious about. Is that going to ruin the glaze? Okay.
Uh-huh. Very much how in pickling, when you make a brine, you heat the water with the salt and sugar so that it dissolves. And it becomes smooth. And so in the glazing, we want to make sure that we're whisking the sugar in with the liquids and then applying it to the vegetable or the meat or whatever it is that we are doing in the heat process. But yeah, you can use any kind of sweetener, really, for glazes. It's a matter of reducing the liquid enough to create that shine.
Okay. And I think that's where my question about aromatics came in, was that do sometimes glazes ever add to the overall, like, is it like the last finishing touch of a food if you put a glaze on that you've added,
yes,
like lemon or vinaigrette or something like that to it? Like a savory, is glaze savory ever considered that, or is it always considered sweet?
I think it can sit in both families. I think maybe savory and sweet. Glazing tends to be at the end of the cooking process because the sugar otherwise will burn in the beginning.
Okay.
If you have prolonged contact with a heat source, it tends to burn. But there are definitely cooking methods where you add that at the beginning, and by the end, it becomes a reduction that is a glaze. But I can't speak specifically to examples right now. We'll have to dig some up and share some.
Okay, great.
But then, I love a glaze.
I feel like everybody loves a good glaze. And I have, I think, you know, one more question. And that's when you're grilling and you're putting, you know, the barbecue sauce and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And this might be an easy one. And maybe I should know the answer to it. Is that called also, like, if I was grilling, you know, my ribs or whatever, and I'm using the brush, I'm glazing right then, right? If I'm putting the barbecue sauce on, is that, I'm glazing or no?
Is the act of basting, yes.
Okay.
The act of basting. But if it has like a sugary majority in the sauce. So I would say like Hawaiian huli huli chicken tends to be shiny when you grill it.
Right.
So that is what I would say is glaze. It's like the visual element, the sugar content. And yeah, it's just like the pottery. If we go back to the pottery definition,
I love that.
We are adding a sheen to it.
Yeah, so there's a visual element to it. That's excellent.
Mm-hmm. Audio, visual, sensory, experience. It's glaze.
I love it. It's a delicious dessert. And that's probably why it inspires so many other interesting desserts that come from it, because you can play around with it, and it's a visually stunning piece at the end. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, with the marble, the mirror cakes and stuff like that. And
oh, yeah. We get into that in the episode for sure.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I love it.
So we go from glaze then to deglazing, which are similar, but not, they're similar, but not really that similar.
Right.
So, but they're that's kind of, you go,
they're
I'm
related.
Sorry.
They're related.
They're friends. Well, like I said, they all three of them stuck out because there's liquids involved. And as you said, there's pans involved. Mm-hmm. And deglazing, though, is also sort of, it's at the end. It's one of the finishing touches of the meal. And like I said, I didn't always realize I was deglazing until I really understood what the definition was. And
is there an item that you deglaze more than others?
I think chicken. I feel like I end up deglazing, if that, you know, makes sense.
All right. Yeah. For me, it's mushroom.
Okay. So I end up sometimes cooking like chicken in different stages depending on what I'm doing. So I have to like take a couple steps back. I'm not a great cook. I'm never going to claim to be that at all. Or even like, I'm like, any knowledge I have was like sort of self-taught during college.
Mm-hmm.
So, and right now, you know, my husband and I, Sky, we're sort of on like, you know, semi-diets, not like a full-out diet, but it's like a low sodium, like watching while reading,
getting
older kind of situation. So I cook very basic stuff with like a few exceptions. But like every so often I try to like, I found a couple of different like vegan like salad dressings and stuff like that. I've thrown them in pans with mushrooms and stuff like that. It's like, I have a shiitake one that I use.
Ooh.
Right. So I ended up like cooking chicken with some mushrooms and then like using the shiitake vinaigrette thing as like.
Yes. Your deglaze.
Yes. So, which I didn't realize I was doing because I kind of was winging it a little bit because I don't really know what I'm doing. So it was like kind of healthy, but it tasted okay. At the end. Let's just leave it at that. All my stuff tastes okay at the end. It's, you know, fine.
All right. Let's talk about the building blocks of glaze.
Right.
So we have an item that we want to glaze. Mm-hmm. And then we have a heat source, the pan, and a liquid solution that we add to it. And that liquid solution reduces and becomes the glaze. Here in deglaze, we've already cooked something. So, for example, your chicken. We've already cooked it. But because of that keyword, Maillard reaction browning, you know, you get those brown bits stuck to the bottom of the pan. How do we release that stuff? Because that stuff is flavor. Mm-hmm. According to our episode about Maillard reactions, that stuff, that brown stuff, the fond, the déglaçage, I think I said that right, is flavor. And the way that you remove that from the pan and get it back into your dish is deglazing by introducing a liquid at high heat and scraping it up from the bottom. And that is deglazing.
Delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to deglaze with a dry white wine on my mushrooms after I've sauteed them.
That sounds very good.
Yeah, and they don't get mushy. And I was a picky eater. I did not love mushrooms when I was little. And it's because I was getting them from cans or they were being steamed, which is not ideal. They get really slimy. So I like to saute them until they release their water and they get some crispy edges. But along the way, you know, they start to stick to the bottom of the pan. Even though you're using olive oil, vegetable oil, there's going to be a point where there's some Maillard browning, and that is the release of sugars onto the pan. And so we want that flavor. So what you do is you turn up the heat a little bit more. You add carefully your white wine, because if you have open flame, it could flambe. Watch out. You might lose an eyebrow.
That's what I was curious about. I was like, if you're throwing a little alcohol into that pan, could it ever get too explosive?
Yes. So that's why we use in small, we use small amounts when we flambe, if you mean to flambe, but just be careful. Any alcohol's going near flame. If you have an electric stove, don't worry, you'll be fine. But deglazing is great because you get all those really lovely flavorful bits from the bottom of the pan, and it becomes its own gravy, or the pan juices, the jus.
The question, and once again, might be silly, but if you're doing the mushrooms, they're sort of sticking to the pan. When do you step in before they might be burning? Like, how do you know? You know what I mean? Like, are they cooking too much? Are they undercooked? When do I throw that liquid in? Is it too long? Is there charring? Like, I don't know. You let me know.
Oh, yeah. As soon as you smell it, if it is charring, that is too hot. Remove the pan immediately from the fire source. There's no turning it down from there. It's just remove the pan altogether, put it on an inactive burner, let it cool down. But if it is smoking, like if it is burning smoking, open a window, put that pan outside away from your fire detectors, because I've set off so many alarms that way. Even me, you know, I'm a chef too, but I've burnt things before. That is too far. So that's why we stick around the medium high, medium range, so that we don't reach that point. Mm-hmm. But specifically with mushrooms, I don't deglaze until those edges are crisp, that it's sizzling. It has to be audio.
Another all-around food. I like it.
Yeah, it's a very sensory process. I like some browning on the edges. When it looks like it's that mushy texture, it needs to go a little bit further for me, because we want that Maillard browning. That's how we get the good sauce. If it sticks to the pan, it's going to be delicious. But sticking too much is burning, so we don't want that. So this is why you watch your food. You can't really leave food on the stove. This is why we watch things and adjust the heat up or down to our needs.
Is deglazing essential generally to a meal, or is it? I know it's a very tasty part of the process, but mm-hmm. Can you think of a meal where it's like, you have to deglaze at the end? Or is it kind of always something where it's like a little bit of a, I get to it. It'll be fantastic if I do, but if I don't, no one will really miss it.
It is a nice to have if you're in a hurry. Like, you're not gonna die if you don't deglaze it. But pro tip, I think that deglazing really helps you with washing the dishes later.
Yes, I can attest to that, because that may or may not be how it started for me.
Yeah.
So was that I learned that I was like, oh, my nonstick pans is so much easier if I just get everything out if I keep adding the liquid to it.
So if you run out of liquid and you just want to serve dinner and you're just going to leave the pan, a good thing to do is use leftover wine, vinegar, or beer. Straight up water might, you know, warp your pan, but if it's like an alcohol, you might be able to just like scrape off some stuff before you sit down and eat, and then so your dishes are not a nightmare later on. I keep what is the nickname for beers that are left over at a party that someone opened? What is the nickname for it?
I would call the other ones fallen soldiers.
Fallen soldiers. Oh, that is. Okay. That's the word. That's the one.
Okay.
If I am having a gathering and people didn't finish the beers, I actually keep those fallen soldier beers.
That's smart, though.
I can deglaze my pans if I'm not using it as a gravy.
Interesting. That's great to know. That's
just
actually
clean.
Yum. Stop saying yum when it comes to deer like that. But that makes a lot of sense. And I feel like actually people out there, like especially if you don't realize you're deglazing or if you're kind of a novice-ish cook, but you might be in a city somewhere, like living on your own for the first time, and you're gonna have people over having, that might be a great tip for people. Like save those extra beers and like use those later for cooking purposes.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to keep a loose plastic over it or something. Mm-hmm. Or you can refrigerate it. But it's just if you feel comfortable using a beer somebody drank out of. I understand if you don't feel comfortable with that.
I wasn't going to make a comment on it because I feel like, you know what, to each their own, you know, live and let live.
Yeah. You assess your own safety risk, but also leftover wine. And if you don't want to drink it anymore, you can use that for cleaning and deglazing your pans. It's great. but yeah, mushrooms are the thing that I deglaze the most.
I feel like when I cook mushrooms, I end up cooking them with other stuff. But I don't know if I'm supposed to do that or not. But yeah. I think mushrooms are probably also the one I think I end up doing. It's with that specific. It's a shiitake like dressing that I use with it.
Mm, so, that sounds great.
It's actually pretty tasty. Yeah, very. It's a low effort meal, and it's like a low calorie, low sodium dressing. So it's like a very easy. I also wasn't a mushroom fan growing up either. So like, mm-hmm. It's a new taste for me. And it's like the ginger and stuff like that. I add a little bit of ginger. So I add a lot of flavor to it to like make it less mushroomy, but still pretty.
Oh, yeah. Mushrooms are nature's sponges.
They love it. They take off of it. You know, whatever you want to throw at them, they're going to be like, yes, come at me. I welcome you.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. So with deglazing, I love using all sorts of alcohols. So wines, beers, vermouth even, which is really fun. You could use broth. But you know, you're adding more of those flavor elements, so you're gonna have like more of a really flavorful savory gravy there. Okay. Which is great. Yum.
It also sounds pretty tasty. All the better. We should probably talk about some non-alcoholic things in case we have any, you know, minors.
Oh, sure.
Listening. We're learning how to cook for the first time. We don't have so much access to, you know, extra wine just yet.
Yeah, any broth or stock will work there. I don't really recommend juices because you end up going into the glazing territory.
Okay, because
that's a high sugar content. Sugar.
Interesting.
But you could. I mean, you know, pineapple juice is used in some deglazing. But just know that it's going to contain more sugar, so you might end up scraping the pan more than you realize.
Okay, so is there any liquid that's an absolute no to do this with?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't tried.
I want to say probably milk, right?
Would probably burn the milk solids, yeah.
Right.
Unless you were doing it at a very, very low heat.
Okay.
And scraping the bottom of the pan. Yeah. You do like a milk gravy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And would vinegars work as well, or is that too bitter?
Vinegars could work, but yeah, it will be very, very potent, acidic, piquant.
I guess though, like instead of using maybe like a red wine, would you ever like mix like an apple cider vinegar with like a broth and then possibly use it to like cut down? I don't know how that came to me.
I like that. Honest, I want to try it now.
Okay,
that's right, non-alcoholic because vinegar comes from wines and spirits. So mixing it with a little bit of broth could be a great non-alcoholic
and then
way of deglazing. Yeah.
All right. Yum.
Cool.
I love learning new things.
I love it. So creative.
That's the fun part of talking with you, Jen, though, is like I get to ask you questions and I'm like, it's kind of like going to see your doctor or like meeting a doctor friend and like you're like, oh, like this is a weird thing on my arm, but I get to ask Jen stuff about like, oh, like Jen, like I really like effed up in like the kitchen the other day. Like, but I say it to her in like weird ways that are like, oh, you know,
my friend.
I like to pretend, but no, I love asking you like,
oh,
like go.
Am I Frasier and are you Roz?
I didn't want to make that comparison, but now that it's out there.
I mean, I don't love Kelsey Grammer's politics, but I was a huge fan of Frasier.
Yeah, fair play. Same boat. don't want to talk about him as a person, but I will applaud some of the work he has done.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so that's, I mean, so if there's anything, also our audience is listening. If you guys have any questions, she's willing, you know.
Oh, she I love answering this stuff. Yeah, please submit questions to us on Twitter, CulinaryWOTD. I don't have a phone number because we're not a radio station, but folks, we love to hear it.
I just feel like, do people even call into the radio anymore? I don't know. I think they do. I have been listening to the radio. They seem to still
We could do like a Twitch version of this where we do this live one day and we put the questions up on the screen. Like, oh, so-and-so asks.
That'd be so fun. I think people would really like to ask the show questions stuff. Because you're very good. I understand a lot of what you end up saying. And I think that sometimes it can be hard. I think sometimes when you're talking to chefs, there's like a lot of big words that they throw in.
That's true.
And you sort of like, and if you kind of throw in a big word, you also sometimes will like kind of I'll cut it a up. Little bit. Yep. You'll kind of like say like what it is and like how it's applicable in this situation. And I'm like, oh, she's defining and applying as she goes. This is the best.
Thanks.
This is my favorite.
Ah, shucks. Maybe this is why we started a podcast.
This is it. This is why. But it's great. Great. We're high energy today. You know, we've had a
We name. Are.
You know, we have, we're just love it. I love it.
We have a name. It's really energizing to have a name, to be named.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of which, we have a third word that we should get to.
We should get a little sweaty. You know?
Currently, I know this will come out at a later time, but it is currently August in Brooklyn, and I have my air conditioner off because we are recording audio, and I am sweating.
I'm very thankful. You know, it's like, let's all thank Jen for that. I mean, she's taking a hit for us.
Taking a hit.
AC off.
Yeah, I don't have central air. Don't have central air here in Brooklyn. But sweating is the subject of the next conversation here, which is, you know, another cooking method.
So I thought it was interesting when I first started researching it a little bit. Obviously, when you talk about sweating in food, a lot of people like to talk about how food might affect humans actually sweating. So it took me a couple minutes to get into like the groove and like back to the definition. But I did think it was interesting. And I think I saw this comparison, and you can disagree with me or disagree with the comparison, is that one person wrote, you know, sweating vegetables almost looks like human sweating in some senses. Mm-hmm. Like the vegetables are supposed to glisten, and, you know, there's your comparison. So if you want to know what it's supposed to look like, maybe it sounds a little gross, but think of it the same way. And I don't know if you would agree with this statement or not.
So humans do not sweat as much as vegetables do.
Good to know.
I mean, just think about it on a scale, you know?
Okay.
What kind of heat would make a human sweat is significantly lower than that of the vegetables.
Right, because also sweating you need to use low heat?
Low heat, yes, but vegetables are also made up of cell walls, which break down easier than our animal cells do. So you will see more rivulets and droplets on the surface of a vegetable than you would on your own skin. unless, you know, you're in a very humid desert, which is not really a thing that happens.
No, hopefully not. You're probably not listening to us if you're in that humid desert.
So hot. So hot. So sweating, as you mentioned, is a low heat cooking method. It is to remove moisture from vegetables, or not remove. It's more of a, it's in between, right? Like it's before you saute something, or it's low enough heat that it's not a stir fry or a saute. Sweating is the precursor. Again, it's a step before something else.
So it's our out of these three words, it's our beginning word. It's our beginning food prep word. Instead of the end of the foods, this one, we start out with a good sweating.
Yeah, so I would say the most sweated vegetable is the onion. And the reason for that is it has a lot of cell walls that need to break down. And there are varying levels of breakdown an onion can go through. Like, we start with the sweating, and then we get down to as far as caramelization. So that's like the really broken down, spreadable brown onion mixture over low heat. It takes a long time. There's a lot of social media chatter about how recipe developers are lying about how long it takes to caramelize an onion. It's not 10 minutes. It couldn't possibly be 10 minutes. Friends, those onions that are done in 10 minutes are sweat. They're sweated onions. Those are not caramelized onions.
So wait, how long does it take to caramelize a full onion?
Depending on the water content and your heat source, it could be up to 45 minutes or up to 2 hours, depending on how many you're cooking.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's a long time, but, worth it, I say.
Oh, totally.
Worth the wait.
Worth the wait. But if we're sweating, we're only like the 10-minute range.
Right. Yeah. We are softening our vegetables. That's the principle behind sweating. It is, you know, if you're going to be stir frying something or you are par cooking these onions, you don't want to put raw onion into a dish because it takes the longest. So sweating is removing that moisture, softening it to a better texture, a more desirable texture, and then continuing on in the process. So from there, you can do braises. You can transfer to the oven to roast with other things over a bed of softened onions. Hooray. It can be a saute. It can be the beginning of a soup. Yum. So you don't have, you know, a very stiff half ring of raw onion in your soup.
Interesting. So that's sort of where my next aromatics come in, is that mm-hmm. I was also curious about like the timing of your vegetable sweating. So you'd start, if you wanted to sweat, say like three different types of vegetables, you generally would start with your onions because they take longer.
Start with the one that takes the longest.
Okay, so the timing is important in that sense.
Mm-hmm. So onions tend to be up there. Carrots are up there. Anything that's thick and starchy. Potatoes, not something you sweat.
Right.
They're just so dense.
They're dense.
But this is more of your beans, your green beans, your snap peas, your verdant vegetables.
Some peppers. Throw some peppers.
Some peppers, yeah, yeah. Things that have you know, very planty cell walls. You wouldn't sweat spinach. It's so fast.
Yeah, right.
You wouldn't really sweat that. So things that are more fibrous, but not starchy. So like collard greens need a long time to cook.
Gotcha. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I guess, yes. It'd be fun to see like a little scale of like what can be, you know, sweating to like, I guess, caramelize it. You know what I mean? Like, not like you can't caramelize everything, ooh, but you know what I mean? Like a little graphic of like where on the, like the floor, like the flow is like, where do you throw an onion in? Or like, where does this change happen to which one? Like,
oh, this hit? Could be a fun crowdsourced project on our Patreon. Since we use that visual board Miro,
mm-hmm.
we could do a running spectrum of what you're talking about. We just have a live version of the words we talked about. Where is it on the scale of
of what is, I mean, if we're going to add to a debate possibly about how long something does or does not take to get to its end goal, I mean, this could just you know, like, let's see what people have to say about it.
We'll have a research battery of caramelizing onions. That's really fun. Okay, reminder to Jen, who is editing this later. Start a Miro board and invite the Patreon folks to join in. That'd be first, fun.
Yeah, first step in, like, you know, how to cook vegetables.
Ooh, I love this.
Which I think is an important thing. It's like, because I think it's actually, I think vegetables can be kind of confusing. Like, meat is confusing in its own way because is it too cooked, undercooked? But I think vegetables, like, when do you add them first?
When do you add them? The order of operations. Oh, yeah. we should make a visual guide for this. There, you're so right. I love that.
Visual guide to your veggies. And they're, you know, they're the sort of, in our inflated grocery times, they're the, sort of the cheap thing to buy these, or one of the cheaper things to buy. So if you're going a little veg diet as opposed to a meat-based protein diet, you know, how do you cook those veg? How do you get those new meals going?
I love this.
Interesting.
We're here to help. What else is on your mind in terms of sweating?
Well, I thought of cooking it. How much oil is it? Is it like, is it like a drop, a little bit, enough to clear the pan? I actually make that mistake a lot about either putting too little or too much oil in things. And I'm like, did I accidentally just deep fry something?
Right. So my default, depending on the size of your pan, I tend to start with a tablespoon of any oils and then go from there. The purpose is to just barely coat the entire surface area of the pan. Anytime you're going more than that, you get into frying territory. Even you can see, you know, a depth of oil. That means that you're about to get into frying territory. But sweating does not require a lot of oil. Because you are applying low heat and you are just trying to draw moisture with that heat. You're not necessarily frying or getting a texture on it, or you're not trying to get brown edges. Like, the heat is too low for that. You're just trying to soften them.
Gotcha. And this is another diligent form of cooking, right? Because you're not leaving these like vegetables or, you know, anything on there too long.
Right.
So is it sort of the first sign of browning you want to get them off, or do you want to get them off before any signs of browning?
It depends on what you're going to be cooking.
Okay.
Actually, and if you are going to be making a gravy or if it's going to be part of a soup, because I always want browning if I want deeper flavor in a sauce.
Okay, interesting.
Later on.
Is mm-hmm. that so just browning kind of just brings that, is that just brings more of the sugar into it, or is mm-hmm. it just, gotcha. I see, I'm learning too as I go along. I love
yeah, this. But again, sweating is just a pre-step before you move on to something else, because you could very well get into a saute or stir fry after that. So if you've softened this item, you can mm-hmm. raise the heat and then continue into a
yeah. So it really is like, it's a starting point of like, you can go in almost any direction. If like you're confused or you don't know what you want, might want to make, it's almost like the best first step to do it is like, I've got some vegetables,
just start there. Yeah,
just start and like see where your like mind might take you.
Yeah, just start sweating some onions, peppers, and garlic. We'll get into this in some later episodes, but like sofrito is the beginning of a lot of dishes. Yeah. The Trinity is also a good base. Your mirepoix is a good thing that starts to sweat. Like that's a lot of basis of a lot of French cooking, and soups and things like that. So it's just the beginning. We're still at the very beginning of cooking experience here on the show.
It's good. The mirepoix thing, that's actually one of my other weird cooking recipes during the sort of dietist thing we did, is I actually took that and started sweating them one day. And I ended up making a buffalo chicken, like not a stir fry, but like I sort of sweated those a little bit, took them out of the pan, started sauteing, I guess, the chicken. And I was like, what if I mix these and then, you know, all together and like a buffalo chicken mix, like ooh, put it in a lettuce wrap with like a little cheese on top. It was delicious, actually. It worked out very well. Like
look at you, improv. Wow.
I mean, I bought all the vegetables already chopped up and mixed together. So, like, it wasn't, like, a really far
that's
stretch.
That's fine. If you don't have time, I'm not going to waggle my finger at you.
But that was sort of an example of, like, I just started and I was, like, I had it. They were going bad. And I was, like, what am I going to do with this? I think I was going to make this, like, a meat sauce or something like that, a red sauce. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have all the stuff for that. But I was, like, let me just start cooking this. I know I have chicken. I'm, like, I can figure out something from here.
Oh, you're so right. It's a good substrate, a good base.
Yeah.
Like it's yes. Like, and that, actually, I forgot to mention, that is the definition of the word fond. Like, going back to deglaze, the definition of the word fond, it's not being fond of a person. I mean the fond that those small particles of brown food at the bottom of the pan is the fond. And it's like the background. The basis of your dish. Okay. That's where it comes from.
That's so cool. I saw the word. I didn't necessarily know what it meant. And then I kind of gathered based on context clues. But that's so cool. That's the background of the dish. That makes mm-hmm. so much sense. I love that.
Which is why we always want to save it when we're deglazing. That's why deglazing is so important.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So it's really the building blocks of making a great meal. You know,
yes.
Like learning how to put everything together to really bring out all the different flavors that you don't even necessarily know you're putting together, but it's going to come together in something great.
Love to put a name to a cooking technique. Love it.
I mean, I think that's the funnest part about this too, is because a lot of people are maybe doing some of these things and it's great to actually know and then be able to talk about what you're doing to other mm-hmm. people, you know, and then it's not like, oh, I'm trying to explain this weird recipe I threw together. Like, no, you're actually doing something. Like you're doing something real and like making something delicious and you're doing real techniques and it's interesting. It's very cool.
I mean, look at how evolved we are. We are feeding ourselves. Like, this is what sets us apart, really. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah. It's the thumbs that got us the, you know, the pans.
Yeah, there you go.
So,
the thumbs that got us the dealers.
I have a question.
Yes.
What is your, I'm going to assume it's something, but what is your favorite thing to sweat? Like, if you're like, you know, onion is probably the favorite. It's the basis one. Was there a surprise vegetable that you're like, ooh, I love to throw that in and like see where it's going to take me or see what's going to be in a dish? Is there an interesting?
Oh, my. Let's see. What has rigid texture that I like to sweat? Goodness. I mean, I mentioned it earlier, collard greens, they really need to break down before a long cook.
Okay.
But you do some onions and garlic before that. Because it's still, you know, the base. So I would say I put those together. Like, I like to sweat my onions and garlic and then steam the collard greens on top of that before I add my pot liquor, my lovely flavoring agents. Yum. But yeah, this is you'll always see onion and garlic at the beginning of a lot of recipes. Always the onion first and then the garlic, because the garlic is much smaller and could burn more easily.
I feel like I need to be reminded of that a lot. Yeah. So I feel like it's good to always reiterate the garlic is smaller, it'll burn more easily.
Yeah. I mean, look at your cutting board when you're prepping things. Like, look at, like, do this test. When you have different vegetables that you are about to cook or stir fry, whatever you're going to do with them, just hold them between your thumb and forefinger and squish it. Honestly, you will learn so much. Be like, oh, I should cook this first. Like a carrot, you cannot squish that.
Right. No, I think that's actually a great test. Yeah. I wouldn't have.
The squish test.
The squish test.
I invented something.
I love that. Yeah. While cooking, in your beginning stages, make sure with your veggies, go through, you know, yeah, potatoes. That's not going to ever pass.
That's not going to.
And yes. If it does, throw it away. You don't want to eat that potato.
That's bad. But yeah, like if you have a lineup of vegetables that you've just diced and cubed, put one of each of them between your thumb and forefinger and give it a little squeeze. And the ones that give way are the ones that are the put in later.
In later categories. Once again, we could probably make another chart, but
we'll make another chart.
Yeah, we'll make a list.
The squish test chart. Yeah, there we go. I love it. My goodness. Well, I'll start a Miro board with all of these charts that we're going to make, and we can all contribute. It'll be so much fun. But folks, I think it's time to start wrapping up. Alicia, any other additional thoughts you have about these set of words?
No, I think this is a great set. I think we covered a lot of interesting things. Once again, stuff we may be doing or may not have been doing, but important tasty touches to food.
Yeah. So, if you think of it, consider deglazing, yes, folks, on your next dinner or lunch or whatever it is that you're cooking. It's a nice to have. You don't have to do it, but it'll add a little more dimension to what you're making.
It's an easy step, and then it's an impressive step, especially if you're a novice cook. If you're starting out, it's something that'll impress people that you're cooking for. If you've been, you know, in the stages of learning how to cook, it's like a fun new surprise, I feel like.
Yeah.
You know, you've been serving that bland chicken with some veg on top, and then, ooh, but all of a sudden,
You have a glaze.
You know, and
you have a pan sauce. Now you know how to make pan sauces.
And I think that's a very impressive skill to have. That's you're on like a second date or first date, you bring them home and you're cooking for them. Actually, I don't know what date that would be, but whatever date it might be. And you like, you bring off the pan and like pour the sauce on. It's an impressive.
Alicia moving fast here.
I don't know when you bring them home for cooking. You know, home and for other things maybe, but cooking, I don't know when you cook for someone.
And with that, folks, if you have any questions for us, please do tweet at CulinaryWOTD, comment on our Patreon, and tell a friend about Culinary Word of the Day. Signing off, I am Jen, and this podcast is now called Echelente. All right. Bye, everybody.